Okay, Zechariah chapter 9. I don't know. I seriously doubt if it all came out in the first 8 chapters in our discussions of Zechariah. It's really a lot more difficult for me to get my very long commentaries into these short Bible discussions that we have here on Wednesday evening. But discussing, and I made this summary when I did my commentary on Zechariah back in 2016, I summarized what I thought about the first 8 chapters of Zechariah, and I would like to repeat that here just to get us started. So I wrote, discussing the previous 8 chapters of this prophecy of Zechariah, we hope to have established that there are actually a series of rather profound but complex prophetic visions which have two purposes. First, in the interpretation which we call the near vision, they are a prophecy of the immediate circumstances of the building of the temple and the founding of the 70 weeks kingdom. And we saw that especially with the example made of Joshua the high priest in Zechariah chapter 3 and his facing Satan. And that word Satan simply means adversary. And that many of the surrounding peoples in Palestine did not want to see the people of Judah rebuild the second temple. They tried to prevent that for years. So Joshua did indeed face that trial, but they got the temple built. And with that, he himself is a type for Yahshua Christ, for Jesus Christ, who faced the same trials from his adversary in building the body of Christ, which is his church, which is the true temple of Yahweh. So that's the more important interpretation, which we call the far vision, that these things are prophetic of the ministry of Christ and the building of his body or his church as the temple of Yahweh. So as we have also seen, this true temple was to be built in the captivity of the woman in judgment. That's when the woman in the ephod is taken away with the wings of these angels or eagles. I forget exactly what it says a couple of chapters ago. And she's taken to Babylon. And that was a symbol of her being taken into captivity where the true temple of Yahweh was going to be built. The purpose, the entire purpose of the second temple and the 70 weeks kingdom was outlined in Daniel chapter 9, and it was to produce and herald the Messiah. That was the only purpose for that kingdom. So the overall purpose of Zechariah's prophecy was to foretell these events and the circumstances and the purpose of his coming, and that's what we see here. So now, as we proceed with this chapter, and this is a feature of nearly all the prophets, we see burdens and warnings and prophecies or oracles against some of the people in the surrounding nations because they gave the children of Judah, a hard time in getting the second temple built. So yes, we could start with that. That's sufficient.
The burden of the word of Yahweh in the land of Hadrach. And Damascus shall be the rest thereof, when the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward Yahweh. And Hamath also shall border thereby, Tyrus and Sidon, though it be very wise. And Tyrus did build herself a stronghold, and heaped up silver as the dust, and fine gold as the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he will smite her power in the sea, and she shall be devoured with fire. Ashkelon shall see it, and fear. Gaza also shall see it, and be very sorrowful. And Ekron, for her expectation, shall be ashamed. And the king shall perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon shall not be inhabited. And a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. And I will take away his blood out of his mouth, and his abominations from between his teeth. But he that remains, even he, shall be for our God, and he shall be as a governor in Judah, and Ekron as a Jebusite. And I will encamp about mine house because of the army, because of him that passes by, and because of him that returns. And no oppressor shall pass through them any more, for now have I seen with mine eyes. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king comes unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, and upon a colt, the foal of an ass. And I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim, and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off. And he shall speak peace unto the nations, and his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even to the ends of the earth. As for thee also, by the blood of your covenant, I have sent forth your prisoners out of the pit, wherein is no water. Turn you to the stronghold, you prisoners of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee. Bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and made you as the sword of a mighty man. Yahweh shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth as the lightning, and Yahweh God shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with whirlwinds of the south. Yahweh of hosts shall defend them, and they shall devour and subdue with sling stone, and a noise as through wine, and they shall be filled like bowls and as the corners of the altar. And Yahweh their God shall save them in that day as the flock of his people. For they shall be as the stones of a crown lifted up as an ensign upon his land. For how great is his goodness, and how great is his beauty, shall make the young men cheerful, and new wine the maids. End of Zechariah, chapter 9.
I want to comment on this. I want to start with chapter 8 and the last verse of chapter 8. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all the languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew. But in this context, it should never be Jew. It should be a man of Judah, a Judahite, or a citizen of Judah, which would include the tribe of Benjamin and elements of the tribe of Levi, because there were 2.5 tribes in the kingdom known as Judah after the divided kingdom. And they will say, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. And I would insist that that's an actual prophecy of the period of the apostles, who were basically men of Judah. Even if they were of the tribe of Benjamin, they were still of the kingdom of Judah, and they were called Judeans. And they announcing Christ, announcing the gospel of Christ among the other nations where the children of Israel were scattered. Those 10 men represent the 10 tribes. Of that, in that prophecy, they would represent the 10 tribes that would come to Christianity following the apostles, taking hold of their skirt, right? Is believing and following after them. And this first verse of Zechariah chapter 9 supports that interpretation, even though it's a burden of Yahweh in the land of Hadrach and Damascus. That's where the children of Israel were first sent, were to Syria. And many of them were settled in Syria. And most of the people taken in Babylonian captivity were settled in what became Syria. And that's very obvious in the words of Josephus. If you read the prophecy in Amos, it said to the children of Israel that they would be taken beyond Damascus. And here we have a rough description of that land. When the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward Yahweh. Well, that happened when the scattered Israelites became Christians. And one of the biggest seats in of early Christianity was at Antioch, which was just beyond Damascus in Syria. So these chapter divisions very often just suck. And you even hardly ever hear any pastors or commentators commentating on passages that span chapter divisions. But the chapter division didn't exist in the original text. They're a medieval concept. And there was no break in the concept, in the context in the original text ever between verses and chapters, because verses and chapters didn't exist. So this Zechariah chapter 9, verse 1, it corroborates and justifies what we had said about Zechariah chapter 8, verse 23, the last chapter of chapter 8. I don't know if you want to discuss that or anything before we discuss this particular chapter further.
It's just really disappointing how many people don't consider that the chapter divisions are arbitrary.
No, they don't. And I constantly see mainstream commentaries and sermons that I come across in the course of my week. And they always stop at the end of a chapter. Even when I know that there's context relevant to that discussion in the opening verses of the next chapter. It's rare that they span a chapter. In my opinion, it's rare that I see it.
No, often it runs for several chapters. I've made tables for the prophets, and it does.
Well, right. It's even in Paul in Romans chapter 9, I tell people all the time that his comparison of Jacob and Esau and his prayer for his brethren according to the flesh runs all the way through chapter 12.
Yeah.
Or at least into chapter 12.
Speaking of brethren, sorry, Bill.
Where he says all Israel will be saved, he's talking about his brethren according to the flesh. He's not talking about Esau, whom he compared them to in Romans chapter 9. He's talking about those who are really Israel in Israel and not those who are not of Israel in Israel. That's the comparison he made in Romans chapter 9. But they refuse to consider that in Romans chapter 11. But the subject doesn't change.
Yeah, it's especially difficult in the epistles because the epistles are just one letter spanning the same subject. To be fair, sometimes the prophets, they switch subject. You'll have an oracle against Moab and now it's against Tyre. They're just going straight through.
Right. But no particular oracle ever undoes everything else
in
the book.
No, I didn't mean it that way. But I just meant like when you see something like that, maybe it's easier to put a chapter division there.
Perhaps, I agree.
And speaking of children according to the flesh, or brethren according to the flesh, and those who are not, we see here in Zechariah that Yahweh doesn't consider bastards people, because if there's bastards in a land, in his eyes, that land is desolate. It's not inhabited. And I think this is one of the best passages in the whole Bible to show that to somebody.
Right.
Yeah, it definitely proves that it's genetic. It can't be that they were born out of wedlock. You know, a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod. That can't be, oh, someone was born out of wedlock in Ashdod.
Only one. Joke. It says a bastard, Joe.
You got me there, Bill.
It's the Antichrist. Guys.
Oh, yeah. That's funny.
I will cut off the fire of the Philistines because one bastard dwelling in Ashdod, I'm being funny, right? But one bastard dwelling in Ashdod, one bastard dwelt in probably every town in Israel. There was one Canaanite somewhere. So one bastard dwelling in Ashdod would not by itself cut off the pride of the Philistines.
Ashdod is still called by that name today or something similar, right?
You know, a lot of those towns are still called, I mean, Gaza is still called Gaza, right? And Gaza was also a Philistine city in ancient times. Even in Abraham's time, I've been discussing the land of Gerar, where he dwelt, south of Beersheba, for many years. That's modern Gaza. That's part of modern Gaza, the land of Gerar. And Abimelech was there, which is a Philistine name for a king that was very common, right? So and there were many Abimelechs, even through the time of David. So it was just a title used by Philistine kings. And there were several Philistine kings. It wasn't just one of them. So he was only the king. He wasn't the king of all the Philistines. He was only the king of Gerar, which happened to be the portion of the coast that the Philistines inhabited that corresponds roughly with the southern part of what we now know as Gaza.
Hey, Bill, you know how you're saying that at the end of chapter 8, it's talking about going tribes of Israel?
Yes.
Well, here at verse 9, it says, "Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem, behold, thy king cometh unto thee." Well, a daughter of Jerusalem, is this like offshoots of Jerusalem, like people in dispersion? Is that what that could be?
Yes, daughters of cities in the scriptures are representative of colonies from those cities. So a daughter of Jerusalem would be an overseas colony of Israelites. It couldn't be an overseas colony of Syrians, because then it would be a daughter of Damascus.
Yeah.
Or a daughter of Hamath or something.
Yeah, so it's like these distant Israelite nations are coming to recognize their king.
Yes, and this is another verse where when Christ said the kingdom of heaven shall be taken from you and given to a nation bearing its fruits, this is another verse that should be cross-referenced to. Just like we see in Micah chapter 4, I think it is, the kingdom shall come to the daughter of Jerusalem. Micah 4:8, the kingdom shall come to the daughter of Jerusalem. So where Christ said that in Matthew chapter 13, it should be cross-referenced. I believe it was Matthew chapter 13. I don't know the Bible. I'm sorry. Matthew 21:43. That should be cross-referenced to this passage in Zechariah 9:9, as well as to the passage in Micah 4:8.
And daughter of Zion, that's just a prophetic way of describing Israel. Is that like a spiritual designation for Israel, or?
No, daughter of Zion itself is the mountain of God, and that's used figuratively for the children of Israel. Very often in scripture, that's very clear in the prophets. Daughter of Zion would be a colony of those people, a colony of Israel somewhere else.
But it's a part of their identity as the people of God, so.
Yes. Nobody else could claim to be a daughter of Zion unless they came from ancient Israel and the Israelites. You can't come from Assyria and claim to be a daughter of Zion, or from Persia, or from Zimbabwe. No.
Yeah. People in Zimbabwe can't say, "Oh, we're all people of God." It's like, well, are you of Israel? Are you of Jerusalem?
They're just daughter of gorilla. The only thing you can call them is daughter of gorilla.
So, Bill, are you trying to tell us that the current city of Jerusalem can't be the daughter of Jerusalem, and that the current state of Israel can't be the daughter of Israel?
A bastard shall dwell.
I don't know what they are.
I think it's Ashdod, but they're also bastards.
Yeah, you know, they are the desolation. Christ said your house will be left to you desolate. And they are that desolation.
Desolate Edom for the same reason Ashdod is desolate here.
Yeah. And Edom will build up the desolate places. Jerusalem is the desolate place that they build up. Malachi 1.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of places that Christians can be shown what we assert in the Old Testament. But there's a real easy place in the New Testament. I just have to think of a keyword or two to use to find it. I got it. Even though it's more typing I wanted to do. Whoops. I can never remember the language of the King James Version. Luke chapter 21, right? Now, this is Christ speaking, and it's like 32 or 33 AD. And he says, and when you see Jerusalem encompassed by armies, know then that the desolation thereof is nigh. And then it says, let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out of it. For these be the days of vengeance. Vengeance for what? How about vengeance for killing him?
Yeah.
Which is what Daniel explains in chapter 9 of his prophecy. These be the days of vengeance, and all things which are written may be fulfilled, meaning all things concerning him. But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people, meaning the people in Jerusalem, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations until the times of the nations be fulfilled. So that's the curse upon all those who rejected Christ. That's his vengeance against them, is that they fall by the sword and be led away captive into all nations. So Christians today are actually resisting the curse of Christ upon his enemies. They're resisting it openly by supporting his enemies.
And there's a parallel prophecy in Jeremiah where it calls them a curse.
Yes, there is. That's parallel with the prophecy in Jeremiah chapter 24, where they're to be led away captive into all nations to be a taunt and a curse. And a reproach.
Taunt and a curse.
A reproach. Sorry, Bill. Proverb.
Those bad figs.
But you don't have to go to Jeremiah. It's in Jeremiah chapter 24, verse 9. You don't even have to go to Jeremiah. If the average Christian would listen for 5 minutes about Luke chapter 20, they would have to stand there and blatantly and directly deny the words of Christ in the gospel to uphold support for Israel.
Yeah. You know, I never considered it this way.
It's amazing how they don't even listen to Christ, yet they're Christian.
They listen to Christ first.
Go ahead, Noble.
Completely deaf to it. As soon as you read scripture like that, or start talking about that, they totally go stupid and reject it. I mean, they don't even hear it.
That's absolutely true, James. And my own cousins, when I told them things like that, said, oh, I got to ask my pastor. Yeah. I'm like, ask your pastor. Can't you fucking read black and white? Ask your pastor. Those are red words, right? The words of Christ. Maybe right. Some titles.
Anyone who is ashamed of my words.
Judeo-tards are all about the red words.
Yeah, but they don't ask their pastor. They used to tell me all the time, I got to ask my pastor, but they never asked their pastor. They just forget about it the minute they left the room with me.
And yet also something that stands out that they won't look at, the Luke 21, what you just read and what we're talking about, Jeremiah, they don't pay no attention to that either. Christ didn't put it, and the prophets and the apostles didn't put a time stamp on that. It's still cursed. That ground over there, the land, the inhabitant priests of that are still cursed. Well, these stupid people that go over to Israel, white people that go to Israel to see the Holy Land. Yeah, the ones that got caught over there. Yeah, and people are pissing and moaning about it. All the Americans that got caught in Israel during the Hamas attack. Well, hey, good for them. Serves them right.
They were not supposed to be there.
Place.
It's in scripture. We're not supposed to go there.
No,
and you know, still
they're cursed.
No, it's still desolate. The desolation curse that Christ laid on Jerusalem has not been removed. Nobody can remove that.
So why are they trying to evangelize to them? Like they're a fig tree with no fruit, and they're going over there and trying to preach to the Jews. It's like you're not going to get good fruit from there. So why are you evangelizing? Do you not believe Jesus?
But the pastor said so, and so did the television.
They love Jews more than Jesus.
Yeah, you know, I don't know where Schofield wrote in his notes. I never read Schofield's notes. I believe in mental hygiene. I would not read Schofield. But somehow, their entire end times paradigm of the return of Jesus cannot happen until the Jews is suddenly magically converted to Christ.
Take two. They didn't believe me the first time. Okay, I guess they will now.
So they support Zionism, and they support getting all the Jews gathered in Israel because they think that has to happen, even though not even 1% of the fucking Jews ever went to Israel. And they support that because they believe that then, when they're magically converted, Jesus is going to return and everything's going to be cool.
Well, I guess it must be
Schofield that convinced them of that crap, but I wouldn't read Schofield to find out. I don't want to read it.
Well, that should have happened like 2 days ago because seeing where Netanyahu in one of his speeches a few days ago, he addressed the Bible and he was, forget what part he even quoted, but he said, as it says in the Bible. So I guess now whenever they're needing money and wanting aid from the U.S.
Yeah, right. Of course.
Now they can believe in the Bible and quote it.
It must have been so unnatural for him to say that.
Yeah. And I was going down the road listening to this, just listening to some of the news commentary of the day.
Well, Jesus will convert them eventually.
And he said, as it says in the Bible,
and the ashes.
You damn dirty Jew bastard. It's blasphemy for them to even speak of it. Or it should be. So now the Jews quoting the Bible, they hate it, but now they're going to quote it to appeal to the American people. Okay.
Yeah, that's the only reason.
Well, they're only placating anybody who's ignorant, right? You have to be ignorant to be placated by them.
Well, can we talk about verse 4, Bill? Because I see here it says, behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he will smite her power in the sea, and she shall be devoured by fire. That feels a lot like today. It feels like we're in hell and we're surrounded by these people who are the sea, and we're waiting for Jesus to, you know, like Peter's walking in the ocean and he's like, Jesus, save me, save me. And Jesus reaches out his hand and he pulls him out of the sea. This feels like today to me. We're surrounded by the power, we're surrounded by the sea. You know, our power is smited by the sea, by these alien peoples, and we're devoured by fire. You know, we're in heavy trial.
Well, right. I mean, that's true. And there's analogies all over the Bible that could be likened to the surrounding of the camp of the saints and the drowning, us being drowned by the flood of the serpent, right? And the earth helped the woman. It's the same analogy. But here it's talking about Tyre, and Tyre's an Israelite city primarily. And it's still an Israelite city at this time, primarily. I mean, there had to be Canaanites there. There had to be Syrians and other people there. That's the story in Ezekiel chapter 37, right? but it's primarily an Israelite city, and it became a very worldly city and a major hub of trade during the entire golden age of Phoenicia. The Greeks recognize it as that. And it was destroyed 200 years later when Alexander the Great came. So, it took 200 years for this prophecy to be fulfilled.
Her power in the sea is like all her ships.
Yes. So for a while, the Phoenician power transferred itself to Carthage and Iberia, but that didn't last too long. That was another 300 years, and Carthage was destroyed by the Romans.
Verse 16.
Another 160 years in the time of Alexander, Carthage was destroyed by the Romans.
Verse 16, that's arise and thresh. That's Christ saving us in that coming day. This is a pretty good verse to cross-reference to Peter, where he mentions that we're all stones in the kingdom of God. For they shall be as the stones of a crown.
Yeah, I love that. I love that because it's like all the people in the land shining who believed in God. They're shining in the land, and it reminds me of the wheat and the wheat and the tares, where after the tares are destroyed, the wheat shall shine forth. You know,
white so the these, harvest.
Yeah, these white people suddenly all the tares are removed, and we shine like the stones of a crown. I love that.
Yeah, but this should also be cross referenced through Philippians chapter 2.
Oh, yes, the stars, yes, amidst a race crooked and perverted.
Yes.
Nice.
Shining like luminaries amidst a race crooked and perverted, yes, because we're drowning in the flood of the serpent, yes.
Now, the but Bible I want to back so up to
that pastor shall dwell at Ashdod, and the Philistines, I mean, they did have Rephaim amongst them and Canaanites amongst them. And they probably didn't have many religious prohibitions to keep themselves from being mixed with those Rephaim. They had a lot of Rephaim mercenaries. Goliath was a Rephaim. He's a primary example of that. Goliath and his brothers. And they had Anakim among them. And that can be pretty much identified. But evidently there were still enough real Philistines, even in Zechariah's time. But where it says a bastard shall dwell at Ashdod, eventually the Philistines were bred out of existence. They don't exist by the time of the New Testament period. They're gone. Now, some of them are probably in Europe, but whoever continued to dwell in the Levant is not identifiable by that name Philistine. They're gone.
They were an offshoot.
Rip.
And today, and for the last 1,500 years at least, all we've had is bastards in the Levant.
Yeah, because they were an offshoot of Egypt, weren't they, Bill? And so all the Egyptians are originally white, and now they're bastardized too. And we've still, I think they've tested the DNA of the pharaohs and connected them to Europe.
Yes. Yes, the pharaohs definitely have European. A very close affinity with your modern Europeans, yes. Modern true Europeans. Northern Europeans. That they said the British was the biggest affinity.
I'm surprised they would even release that information if they did DNA testing on the Egyptian pharaohs, that the Jews would play themselves by releasing that, but I guess they're good at doing that.
You know, as long as it's not on BBC or like Saturday Night Live, then no one's really going to pay attention.
Yeah, it's true.
Now think, what does this have to do with me? And it's like, Egypt was a kindred nation with Israel, and now you're worshiping Israel. Haven't you ever asked, you know, who are these people? That's what it has to do with you, mate.
So verse 6 is describing what you mean with the browning out of Philistines, right? And 7 is describing some of their sins. Or the first half of it, anyhow.
Yes, the sins of the Philistines, but not of the bastards.
Right, but that's what I mean. And the reason that they're all going to become bastards. I mean, and that it reminds me, like, taking the blood out of their mouth, abomination from between their teeth. And, you know, that's the kind of things like that there's sort of rituals with these pagans. You know, they had weird stuff like that, like drinking of blood and so forth.
Yes, they did. But this Ekron shall be as a Jebusite. That's not a good outlook for the people at Ekron.
Yeah.
Jebusites were Canaanites, right?
Yeah, they'll be gone just like Jebusites. They're all gone.
Yeah.
So verse 9 here, Christ is riding on the donkey. And in 1 Kings, Solomon, he requests the mule, which his father David rode upon. And I've thought about this before. David was a great man. He had a heart after Yahweh's own heart, but he was just a man, so he's imperfect. And a big lesson of this life is that the only true king is God, because he's the only one who can rule us righteously. So David, as good as he was, he rode upon a mule, which is a bastard animal and an imperfect animal. And then Christ rides upon a donkey instead, which is part of his creation. That's an animal he created. And I've always wondered if there's some subtle symbolism there. Perfection.
Isn't a mule, can we tell it's a mule from the Hebrew? I thought the Hebrew
was... Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not. I mean, I'm just reading from the King James. Maybe not. I've never done deep study into this. I've just thought about it.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the words right now. Pered is a mule. Perida is a mule. I don't have the etymology in front of me. Strong's isn't open. But I would believe that Pered is probably a mule. And I'll tell you the reason in a minute. Ass is a camor. So yeah, that might be true. That seems to be true. And I'll tell you why I think that's true, just from a... is because... and an ass is not a mule. It's an actual donkey. The word pered, I think, is cognate with the word perez, which is to part or divide. So a pered would seem to me to be a mongrel, right? I mean, I could look that up.
That's interesting.
Could you?
That's just from my own, like, off the top of my head assessment.
Well, I'm just giving an off of the head thought.
I gotta break out my Strong's real quick, because I put my books away in the wrong order Friday when I finished with them.
Yeah,
like, Strong's on the bottom under Jesenius and Brown Driver Briggs, so it takes longer to get. I don't trust this Strong's data in this Bible Works 10. I think it's, every time I go to verify it, it turns out being horrible. Oh, 6505 is the word for mule, pered. Parad is 6504, a verb to break, spread, or separate, right? And a mule, 6505, pered, from 6504, from that verb to break or separate. And Strong's thinks that it's because of something, because its habits are that it's lonely. And I think that's bullshit. I think it's probably called that because something parad or broken, if it's a person or an animal, seems to me to signify that it's made of broken pieces. You know what I mean? That it's like a Frankenstein, like a bastard.
Yeah, when I look at Strong's and his definitions, sometimes I feel like he was so altruistic.
Or yes. Broken.
Optimist.
Broken in the sense that the genealogy has become broken because mules cannot reproduce.
Right.
You cannot you cannot take a horse or a jackass and breed it to a mule and create
all. Yeah, they're sterile.
They're sterile.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
mules don't breed. They can, but it's not going to produce anything, right?
So, yeah, I think that word parad is called a parad because it's a bastard, right?
Yeah, it takes a horse and a donkey to make a mule.
If only all the rest of the bastards couldn't reproduce.
Right. Yeah, I knew it was a bastard animal. I just didn't know it was sterile. That's interesting. I think ligers and stuff are sterile too. That makes sense.
Well, you have John mules, and the females are Mollies. John and a Molly, is that right?
There are examples of crossbreeding of what we perceive as species or kinds that are not sterile. Crosses between wolves and dogs are not always sterile. That's just an example. They're not all sterile.
Right. It seems
I believe ligers are sterile. I believe.
It seems to be kind of an isolated deal where there's only, or maybe not isolated, that's the wrong word to use. Only certain genus of animals that are created are sterile.
Well, a lot of our adversaries think that we're wrong because ears and whites can breed and have kids that could breed, that we must be wrong because they must be the same species. I've been presented with those arguments.
Right.
Yeah, but if you have the same
60 chromosomes, intermediate between a 64 to horse and 62 to donkey. So it's kind of sort of like four-legged Down syndrome, I guess. I don't know, it's weird. That unmatched chromosome. Mules are usually infertile for this reason. Pregnancy is rare, but can occasionally occur naturally. A few mare mules have produced offspring when mated with the horse or donkey. So there you have it.
Yeah, but if we were all the same kind, two white people could give birth to a Chinese baby, or two Chinese people could have like a black baby, and the races would all be.
I understand that. I just repeated an argument that our adversaries make. I didn't say it was valid.
No, I didn't think you were saying it was valid. I'm just saying that that's what I would say to them.
Like you can breed a horse to a zebra, but most of the time they're aborted before they before they're born. Sometimes they do last until they're born, and they can live, but it's not common.
There's ape men in China because the Asians breed with apes, and then they have half ape, half chink people.
Well, I gave an example of a mule that had a foal. And that's at NPR. It's only one example, but it happens. It's recorded right there.
This verse 13, Bill, it says, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece. Don't you have an explanation in your commentary about that and how it's a CI type verse?
Well, first, Greece is Yavanna, And it's not Greece, it's Javan. The Hebrew word is the word for Javan, and that's only a reference to Ionian Greeks. And the Ionian Greeks, of course, were only a portion of the Greeks. There were other principal Greek tribes, and there were the Dorians, and the Macedonians descended from Dorians and Danans. And the Dorians and the Danans, even though the Danans really didn't go by that name any longer by this time.
So when was this war between the Greeks and the sons of Judah?
There were many wars between Ephraim and the Ionians, because the Dorian Greeks, even though their origination is obscure in history, in Homer, who's the earliest of Greek poets, he describes the entire Greek world, and there's no Dorians at all in mainland Europe at the time that Homer was writing of. None at all. There were only Dorians in Crete. And Crete was a halfway point between Palestine and Greece, basically. Maybe a 60% of the way point. And it was a very popular port island. And at the time of the Trojan War, Homer is saying that there were only Dorians in Crete that were known to the Greeks. But he didn't write anything about Palestine, hardly. He mentioned it a few times. He mentioned Sidon once or twice, the Phoenicians a couple of times. But he focused on the Greek world and what was in Europe. There were no Dorian Greeks. By all of the ancient Greek accounts, the Dorian Greeks invaded the Peloponnesus two generations after the Trojan War, which would be about 1120, 1140 BC. And they had war with the Ionians constantly after they invaded the Peloponnesus. And of course, the biggest of those wars were the Peloponnesian Wars, but they're after this time of Zechariah, 100 years after Zechariah, or the Peloponnesian Wars. The Ephraim, even though Dor was a city of Manasseh and Ephraim are brothers and they're close, and Ephraim would have been, Dor was the big port city in the combined lands of Ephraim and Manasseh. And that must be the source of the Dorian Greeks. So you have all those wars between the Dorians and the Ionians, which went on for centuries. And that's the struggle between Ephraim and these Greeks, which are really Ionians.
In your commentary, sorry, Bill.
I'm sorry, go on.
Well, it says, so this is where Zechariah is a Christian identity prophet. It may be claimed that the near vision of this prophecy is related to the struggles between the Greeks and the Judeans of the second century, where the Maccabees had thrown off the yoke of the Seleucids. However, the Greek rulers of Syria were not truly Javan or Ionians, and all they did was free themselves from Macedonian rule.
Right. Because a lot of mainstream commentators like to associate this prophecy with that. But that can't be the fulfillment of this. Because the Macedonians were chiefly Dorians and Danans mixed, and some other tribes mixed in with them, Illyrians and things like that. But they weren't Ephraim. The Judeans were not Ephraim ever. There were no Ephraimites, no members of the tribe of Ephraim in Second Temple Judea that can be counted anyway. I mean, there may have been some that were Greek mercenaries or something over the centuries, but there was no presence of Ephraim in Judea. So no, this can't fit. This doesn't fit that circumstance between the Maccabees and the Seleucids. But I've seen commentaries make that claim, which is why I addressed it in my commentary. So hopefully that makes sense. Judah was in Troy, and the Trojans were at least in part, in large part, Judah. The Romans were in large part Judah. And the Illyrians were in large part Judah. But they weren't a substantial portion of the Macedonians either. And even though there were probably members of the tribe of Judah, people descendants of the tribe of Judah among the Macedonians, here it's saying Judah and Ephraim would be fighting against Greece, not for Greece, right?
Yeah, especially. I'm sorry. I was going to say, you mentioned that Judah would be somewhat mingled with Macedonians because Dardania was right beside Macedonia.
Yeah, so, well, I said Illyria, right? I'm sorry. I took it for granted everybody would know that the Dardanians were Illyrians. The Dardanians are a tribe of the Illyrians, the ancient Illyrians.
But they're all Judahites.
Yes. In my opinion, they are.
I mean, they're named after Darda.
Yes. Oh, yeah, right. The Dardanians, definitely. But some of the tribes in Illyria had other names. So these, when I bent Judah for me and filled the bow with Ephraim and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, this is speaking in the past tense, and it's basically speaking about all of the wars with the Trojans and the Illyrians and the Greeks and especially the Dorians. How much of Judah was among the Dorians? Who knows? Because people, yeah, you know, when it's a port city that becomes popular, look at the history of the United States. People from all over, from every state, have always flowed into New York City seeking fame and fortune. And they always ended up disappointed and broken. No. People flock into those cities from all over the place. And I'm sure the same thing was true in the ancient world, that when Dor and Tyre was originally a city of Asher, and Dor was originally a city of Manasseh, that other Israelites must have flowed into those cities seeking prosperity, seeking to make money and trade and seafaring and things like that.
And the niggers dealt in drugs.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, in your commentary, Bill, you also mentioned that letter that the Spartans wrote to the high priest at Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's recorded in 1 Maccabees chapter 12, and it's recorded in Flavius Josephus in his Antiquities. I don't really remember which book, but I could probably find it pretty quick. It's book 13, I think, or maybe 12.
No, just as long as we know it's in there. I don't think you have to find it because it is in there. But yes, that's what this is all about. That's relevant to this.
Yes, absolutely. It's definitely in 1 Maccabees chapter 12. That I remember very, very well. I'll probably come up with the other one. Pretty quick. It's in Antiquities book 13, like I said. Whoop. That may not be the right letter. Yeah, Antiquities book 12. So I was kind of half right. That was my second pick. There's another letter in 13. It's in Antiquities book 12 from line 225, 226 forward. Arius, king of the Lacedaemonians, to Onias, sends greetings. We have met with a certain writing whereby we have discovered, and it must have been a writing they trusted, right? that both the Judeans and the Lacedaemonians are the same family and are derived from the kin of Abraham. Period. End of story. Lacedaemonians were the Dorians. They're a branch of the Dorian Greeks, and they came from Dor in Palestine. That's the only way they could be the seed of Abraham, and that's why Paul wrote to the Corinthians, who are also Dorian Greeks, if you study the history of Corinth, and they were told by Paul that all their ancestors were in the cloud in the sea with Moses, which is true of the Dorians, because they didn't migrate until a couple of hundred years after the invasion of Joshua and the Israelites into Palestine. It would not have been true of the Trojans, because they left from Egypt, or the Danans who left from Egypt. But it would be absolutely true of the Dorians. So I think we beat Zechariah 9:13 to death. I don't know.
Yeah, so do Zechariah.
Those wars between the Dorians and the Ionians, and even the Achaeans, who were probably elements of the original Danans in the Peloponnesus, those wars lasted until the Romans came and conquered them all. Well, first Philip of Macedon came and conquered them all, and then the Romans. Because all they did after the Peloponnesian Wars, from the whole time of the Persian Wars down, all they did was spat between one another in these petty political spats. And that's because they could no longer make war with each other, because they basically decimated each other, the Dorians and the Ionians, in the Peloponnesian Wars.
Yeah, and the time of the writing of Zechariah is similar to the time of that war. It just finished.
No, it didn't start yet. The time of the writing of Zechariah is about 520 BC, and the Persian Wars started. And for the most part, there was no major strife between Dorians and Ionians in the century leading up to the Persian War. There really wasn't.
So I think 30 years later.
The Persian War started in 490 BC with the Battle of Marathon, and ended in about 468 BC with the defeats of the Persians at Potahir and Thermopylae and Salamis, and the return of Xerxes to Persia. So the Persians were in large part responsible for the Peloponnesian Wars, because they couldn't conquer the Greeks. They wanted to foment division between them. And they had agents in Greece constantly fomenting strife between the Dorians and the Athenians. Yeah, and that's noted. That's noted in Xenophon, in his Hellenica, I believe, and some of the other writings.
Yeah, it was the only way to win or try to win. But yeah, it's just at roughly the same time as this being written, it makes sense that this prophecy of the Greeks fighting Israel, or at least the Ionians.
Well, the Ionians fighting with the Dorians, yeah, because it did. It came to a culmination over the next a century later. When the walls of Athens were destroyed, I forget the exact year. It was 420 something, I think. 410 something. And that's probably why so many Greeks were willing to march with Xenophon to Babylon to defeat. It was the Persian governor of Western Anatolia, what became known as Asia, to defeat his brother, and I believe his name was Artaxerxes IV, around 405 BC, but Cyrus got killed instead, and it didn't work out too good for Xenophon.
So really, no mainstream churches understand that prophecy at all.
No, because none of them understand history. They, especially Baptists, Catholics don't read the Bible hardly.
Right.
And I know the Baptists say the only books you need is that 66 books in the King James Bible. You don't need anything outside of that. Bullshit. If you don't understand history, you can never understand prophecy. So they say you don't need anything else, and then they don't read three quarters of the prophets. They only want to believe the parts about Jesus. They pick out the parts about Jesus. That's the only prophecies they can possibly understand. And they think that's enough.
We're in a sad state as a people.
Right. Absolutely. But that's the Judaization of Christianity that's been going on since the second century that got us there.
Everyone who reads the Bible doesn't read the classics, and everyone who reads the classics doesn't read the Bible.
Right. And it's a shame.
Should we read chapter 10? It's pretty short.
I think we should wait on it because 10 and 11
are sort of like a pair.
Well, no, I'm looking, we got five chapters left, and even if we read chapter 10, it's still going to take us two more weeks, I think. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
So at this point at 10 p.m., it's our usual breaking point. It's probably better to leave 10 anyway, I'm being honest.
Well, this is pretty good. I just want to say it's not my fault. I didn't make us take too long.
Joe, we were waiting for you, but you didn't show up, so we started without you.
You got me.
It is your fault.
I'm lying because you listen to the recording right. And see I'm lying, but I thought it was a good opportunity to get you.
Okay, I'm going to stop it.